nice building, not as nice as here, but we're always looking for people to drop by and say hello. So if you are feeling cold sometime, like the summer in Santa Barbara, I think it's Mark Twain who said the coldest winter I ever spent was summer in San Francisco. I'm sort of feeling that here as well. A little bit of publicity with a good a forward from a member of the audience. If you want to read more. Okay, so this is second in the series on dynamics of domain walls. Fortunately, I don't have to say as much in the way of introduction because Cantata has already done that for me. This is a collaboration also with a Japanese connection with Sadamichi Miyakawa and Jun Ieda from the IMR Tohoku University. Okay, so a little bit of background experiment. Okay, let's worry about domain walls in the simplest model you can ever have. Try and keep also some of the audience happy. So let's look at the Stoner model instead of the SD exchange model and worry about tor transfers. And one of the things I really want to try and convince you exist in domain walls and you should be worrying about if you're going to do experiments on them is that they generate motive forces, which doesn't fit in Faraday's law. Okay, we'll talk about that a little bit. Okay, one of the key differences between what you heard so far and what I want to tell you has to do with relaxation. I'd like to say a little bit about that, then review a little bit what we've already been over, which is how critical currents in experiments relate to possible theoretical approaches. And then if there's some time left, our patented or patent-pending devices that are based on this EMF. Since there's a tradition here we're doing chalkboard seminars, I tried my best to make this look like a chalkboard. But, I said try, I'm not saying I succeed. Okay, so domain structure in iron has a long history. This is Sadamichi's slide. That's a very pretty picture. I'm not exactly sure how it was taken, but there's a very long history, and I noticed Tohoku University used to be called the Tohoku Imperial University. Being an undergraduate at Imperial College, that sort of gives me some memories. But
That was experiment.
It's a picture, I think, I'm not sure just how it was taken, of the main walls in a piece of iron. It's a very pretty picture. Artificial, yeah. Well, magnetic RAM, which is one of the motivations for worrying about what we're worrying about, is pretty old. This must have cost an awful lot of money because it was a memory of 16K made by IBM for NASA, which is why it had to be expensive. And it's long since been abandoned. Notice the size of the memory. This is almost 6 feet tall. price per bit must have been incredible. But spin torque, the transfer of angular momentum through currents, has a nice scaling advantage. If you want to switch things with a magnetic field, the field of a wire goes down as its radius, whereas the coercive field essentially remains a constant, whereas the magnetization goes as R squared, and the amount of angular momentum you can transfer to something by a wire also goes as R squared, so it's something which scales. So that's hopefully why someone would want to pay us to do this research. Let's remind ourselves about images of normal metals, things like permalloy, and what we prefer to think about a lot of the time, which are half metals. So what a lot of I'm going to say is actually keeping in behind the head that one's thinking about a half metal, but one always has to come back to reality and consider a system with minority and majority electrons when you're really worrying about the physics. So this is a little or no. Up here at the top here is little and the no. From Osaka University, and we kind of missed it, but when you send a current in different directions. This domain wall imaged there moves in the opposite direction to the current. Whilst the slide's up here, let me remind you that although there's no Noether's theorem for spin currents, they're not conserved, it is the case that there's always some spin current that piggybacks on the charge current. So if it's smaller than some polarization times the charge current, then it's going to relax to that value from either above or below. These are the other experiments which Prato was talking about, which are on what they call hull bars, which is and the moving domain wall is seen there at the bottom. These are the experiments of big ONO rather than small ONO. I have a problem telling the difference in pronunciation between the two. The Japanese isn't good enough, sorry. Okay, one's a longer one, the other's a shorter one, if I understood it. Okay, so this is the sort of geometry I'm worrying about. Let's make it a circular wire to get rid of that K perpendicular for the moment. Although we'll think about it later. There's some order parameter n which determines the direction of the local magnetization at that point in space, which has the magnitude Jm times n. I'm going to put a field along the z-axis for the fun of it, and I call the wall width W. When we want to measure an EMF, we're going to put a voltmeter across the ends. Okay, so I think this is what most people would agree is a Stoner model for this system, okay? Schrodinger's equation, there's some momentum, there's the internal field which is pointing along the direction of the local order parameter, and this is the magnetic field that we've applied along the z-axis. So that given that somehow we've calculated what the direction of n is from some function that tells us the magnetic energy as a function of the direction of the magnetization, we assume we've solved that, and we just want to look at the electronic states that we get from solving this, and then in principle there's a self-consistent step to recalculate what n is, but we'll assume that that's been iterated to give us the final solution for the directions of the order parameter. This is spinner, yeah. Okay, so it's a spinner wave function, and I want to solve it. So again, this is what the quantities involved in there were. Okay, so what I want to do is to go to a rotating frame. You can actually show, I sometimes get undergraduates to even do it in the classical mechanics, that if you put a magnetic field on a domain wall, there's no stationary solution if there's not something, some other ingredient added, like some pinning or the system has to have a time dependence. So I go into a time-dependent rotating frame, rotating around the z-axis using this u of phi, and the other trick one does is to put a u of theta, which simply, once I've done the first rotation, takes the y-axis, which is perpendicular to the plane of the wall, and rotates the local axis of quantization, the conduction electrons, to lie along the direction of n. That's what theta does, it tells us which direction of n. So I change to a wave function, which is this primed one here, which has got these two transformations. They look like they're in the wrong order. It's because I'm trying to transform the Hamiltonian, really, rather than the wave function. And that's what you get when you transform things. So you get rid of the magnetic field. It isn't here. The field along the z-axis is now the local z-axis, which is moving as I'm going through the wall. Okay, the momentum term is what it used to be, except for this odd vector potential term in there. Okay, and this is what the vector potential is given by. It's determined by how fast this theta is varying as I go through the wall, and it's directed along the z-direction. This is a spinner wave function, as Garrett's asked, and this is a spin operator operating on that spinner. Okay.
So this is a one electron wave function. The Stoner model is used mainly that if you have n electrons, everyone does the same thing that you do, and then you put on the wire means that you don't let the wave function.
The wave length is. Okay. In principle, the other coordinate is there, but my wire is is wider than the wavelength of the electrons. I mean, I'm not assuming it's that small, but I mean this is essentially the Stoner model. If for a uniform magnet, if I take this term out of there, I just have the internal field pointing along the z direction, which is the direction the magnetization is pointing along. So the only difference between this and a uniform Stoner magnet is this term. Now, what I would normally do in a Stoner magnet is take this, these wave functions, build a slated determinant. Okay, from the slated determinant, because of this splitting, there's a difference between the up and down bands, which self-consistently determines the magnetization. But, I mean, the advantage of Stoner theory compared with SD exchange or something like that is it's a nice single electron theory to begin with. You solve that, build a slated determinant, calculate the magnetization, you iterate the loop in principle, right? That's true. But I'm going to tell you that it's not quite right. So I hate to do that in front of distinguished people. Anyway, so the A, I'm going to throw away for the moment. But it's important, we'll come back to it. But if we were in sort of other group around here, they'd say, wow, this is a non-abelian gauge theory, because that has had a nice spin operator in our vector potential. Okay, so if I throw away the A, I'm back to a Stoner model with no wall in it. And we know how to solve that. There are some periodic solutions that have a given wave vector. There's the splitting of the up and down bands that depend on whether SZ is plus or minus 1, corresponding to majority and minority electrons. So I kind of solved the problem. Okay, the band structure looks something like that. As we were just discussing, you should self-consistently iterate this to get what M is. But in principle, we're through with things. We can go back to the laboratory frame now by just doing the inverse transformations. You can go around calculating things at this point. For some reason, I want to calculate the Bury phase. Why do I want to calculate the Bury phase? Well, because that gives me some other contribution to the vector potential, which when I take the derivative of, is going to give me some forces acting on electrons, which is going to be something to do with this EMF. This should be familiar to you from teaching an elementary physics course, at least we do Bury phase. These R is some parameter in the Hamiltonian, in principle, that you change in order to adiabatically change the Hamiltonian, and you calculate the gradient with respect to this parameter of the wave function, evaluate this, and this is from Bury's original paper, is the part of the phase which is not due to the evolution in the energy of the system. Okay, and you just have to decide what parameter you're going to choose for R. I'll come back to that in a second. Let me remind you what you probably already know, which is if you calculate the Bury phase for the standard problem of involving spins, which is you take a spin 1/2, which you pin down here somewhere, and you take a magnetic field, and you slowly move the magnetic field around some path on a unit sphere. So if the direction of the magnetic field is a unit vector on the sphere, this corresponds to some path of that magnetic field moving it around. And the standard calculation for the Bury phase is, if that's done adiabatically, the Bury phase is given by the solid angle subtended by the path divided by 2, with the sign that depends on whether you started the thing off in the S plus or minus 1 state. Okay, and that result is going to apply here as well, but we're not doing exactly the same thing. What we're worrying about are these electrons that are in a wire, no currents flowing. I'm just solving Schrodinger's equation, which has some position in space, but sees this internal field. So as a function of the position of the electron, if you started off over here, for example, it's pointing along the z direction, so that corresponds to the North Pole. And if you take it through the domain wall, then this magnetic field changes in the local frame of the electron. So instead of sitting the electron fixed and changing the direction of the magnetic field, what I'm going to do is to worry about the electron as its coordinates. It's one side of the wall, or the other side of the wall, or somewhere in the middle of the wall, whatever. Since the situation is essentially identical to what it was in the standard Berry phase problem, the answer comes out to be the same. It's just the solid angle divided by 2 with a plus and minus sign, depending on whether it's majority or minority electrons. And that you can do by simply taking that capital R as being the coordinate in this spin space. So, okay, that's pretty straightforward. You differentiate the wave functions, you get the standard result back again. But the trick now is to change to real space. So I can define the same Berry phase as 1/2. That's actually the spin charge of an electron, h bar over 2 divided by h bar, gives you 1/2 in front of the vector potential, because we're talking about the spintronics, not electronics. There's the vector potential, which is just a way of rewriting the Berry phase. The reason we got into this business is that there's some force which is got by taking the time derivative of that vector potential. Notice this is a different vector potential. The other one had a label T on it and was a spin quantity, where this is essentially a scalar, although it has this plus or minus label, which actually means it's proportional to Sz or sigma Z. But anyway, I have a value for the Berry phase that I got from just the standard result, which is essentially on this side, after I've differentiated it with respect to T and multiplied by the charge of the electron. Well, there's a force which is acting on this electron when it's in the vicinity of the wall. You need the gradient of this cosine, which means the gradient of theta with respect to Z. Okay, so if you take that force and integrate it through the wall, you get a value for the EMF. And actually, you can come up with a formal expression for it, namely the EMF integral of the force through the wall is h bar over e, the charge of whatever the carrier is, times the time derivative of the Berry phase with respect to time. Which is kind of strange, because this is actually Faraday's law. If you again go off to Berry's original paper, he calculates the Berry phase of an electron if you take it around a loop, and the Berry phase is actually, what's it going to be, E over H bar times the magnetic flux. So if you put the Berry phase due to the electromagnetic field, not the one I'm calculating, and plug it into this, this gives you Faraday's law. And what we have is I've plugged the spin Berry phase into here, and this gives me the EMF, or the integral of the force, at least through the wall, that I get for a domain wall. So I'm calling this Faraday's law, or some generalization of Faraday's law, if you will. Why would you want to do that? Well, there are three forces in the current problem. There's the electric field, the magnetic field, V cross B is a force that gives you the regular electromagnetic induction, motional EMFs, and we're just adding in the Stern-Gerlach force, which here can actually give you an EMF. And actually, this is a motional EMF in spin space. I just tried to convince you that in spin space, the coordinate of the electron going from the right to the left of the wall went from the north to the south pole. But because of the magnetic field in this direction, my wall is spinning around, so that the coordinate phi that Professor Tartara introduced is increasing steadily with time, so that this line from the north to south pole is moving around the sphere. So although actually the Berry phase is not well defined within a gauge for a motion from the north to the south pole, once it starts sweeping out an angle, the time derivative of it is. And if you work it out, it comes out that the EMF is given by G mu B divided by E. Now that looks like the Zeeman energy, but it isn't. In fact, the force due to the derivative of the Zeeman energy actually just cancels the force that this represents. But if you want to do electronics with this, the fun thing is to recognize that this magnetic field is precisely putting a pressure on the wall. Putting a magnetic field is not the only way to put a pressure on the wall. You can do it with geometry. So if you have a piece of wire which has this funny looking shape here. The cross-sectional area of the wall depends on where you are. So the wall energy, which is the product of some constant, it's the square root of J times A. Actually, this is this is some other notation. It should be J times A times the cross-sectional area. The air is changing. There's a force. This is the derivative of the energy. You divide the derivative of the energy with respect to the cross-sectional area, and that gives you the pressure. Okay, and that pressure then will produce an EMF. So if you have a wire which is going to shrink, you start off the wall here, there's a pressure makes it move down, and there's a voltage appears across the ends of the wire. So again, that's just to remind you, this is really emotional EMF, and it's a little bit different from other people who've been suggesting spin batteries. Gerrit has his favorite version of it. This is cheating. I got an old picture and put spin battery on it. This is really two-terminal. It's a piece of ferromagnetic wire. You make the wall move down it by hook or crook, and you get a voltage appearing across the ends. Actually, there's quite a lot of energy stored in the magnetic field of a very hard magnetic material, and I have sort of dreams of making a car run on it, but...
can I go back to the few more before I get on the E by you programming things?
Yeah. Sorry, this one?
You say depending on the product part, or other product part.
Sure.
How do you define the E?
Well, as I tried to explain, it's really emotional EMF that you have a derivative of the Berry phase. So although the Berry phase for a non-closed path is non-unique, its derivative, which does define a closed path, is unique. It's gauge invariant. Well, the wall's rotating because I haven't put in the perpendicular anisotropy or anything. But the wall rotates like this, so the phi angle is increasing steadily. So as the electron is going through the wall, the Berry phase going from here to here is pi. And then this is just increasing, this area is just being swept out as a function of time. Again, the Berry phase going through the wall is non-unique, it's gauge dependent. But once you take the derivative, the difference in the Berry phase for this path and this path, which is the path the electron takes at a later point in time, the difference corresponds to going around this path, so then it becomes a unique Berry phase.
Yeah, just think of one's edge. Circuit
in
a wire, the other one is moving,
it's weak, that's why I said it's emotional EMF. Yeah. But it's emotional EMF in spin phase space because the electron actually doesn't have any transverse velocity in real space.
Yeah, but the magnetization.
The magnetization's turning around, but it's. Okay. Okay, so this is what you're supposed to do, is to apply a pressure to this, maybe with a magnetic field, and measure the voltage across it. Of course, although this is a static magnetic field, which will cause, if it's big enough, the domain wall to slide along, there is a time derivative of the magnetization of the wall. So you have to be careful if you're actually going to do an experiment to avoid electromagnetic induction due to the time-varying magnetic field, and you have to worry a little bit about geometry. But one trick is to actually put the domain wall in a confining potential. Okay, then it becomes a harmonic oscillator, and if you drive it at the right frequency, you can make the amplitude of the wall motion change. So you can actually see the effect of the wall motion as an EMF independent of other things. So that's recently what Dr. Sato at Keio, how do you pronounce it, University, presented at, I guess, the Japanese Physical Society meeting, which is the idea that if you can force the domain wall to move around, then it should induce a current in the external circuit. That's just our EMF effect. what he has are these rather cute oscillators, which because there's a small field in this direction, the energy of the domain wall has an energy which is half k times the displacement. There's an effective spring which returns the domain wall to the original position, and then other angle, the phi angle, provides an effective mass. So this looks like a harmonic oscillator. This is the realization of it physically. They're very nice experiments. What he actually does is put a whole series of these in series to try and get a bigger voltage. And what you do is put an AC voltage in this direction to make your domain wall jiggle, and you simply measure with a rectifier the voltage across the ends of the wire. So it's in principle the same experiment, except instead of just making the wall move, you're actually making it oscillate. And what you should see is a bigger voltage when the thing hits resonance, and the voltage coming out of this at resonance, the resonant frequency corresponds to this applied a longitudinal magnetic field, which determines the spring constant. There is indeed a voltage coming out of this. The voltage should actually correspond to the magnitude of the perpendicular magnetic field, which is the one in this direction, and actually is embarrassingly somewhat larger than predicted. But then this is a resonance phenomenon. So that was trying to convince you that you should be running your car on spin batteries. Yeah?
What was the distinction with experiments? Is there still some electromagnetic induction? Because some AC electric field there?
True, but in principle with the geometry there should not be any.
Okay, so just by the geometry you avoid some AC magnetic field generation?
I mean, that you have to worry about, and I mean, I wasn't there for this talk, and I haven't been able to ask him why he's sure that's not happening, but he's a very good experimenter, and I hope he hasn't that he's done things correctly, but it's true, it's a worry. I mean, I prefaced the remark by saying you have to worry about the fact that you have a dm by dt, so there could be some induced EMF from conventional means. No, this was at the Japanese Physical Society, I guess, a couple of months ago. Okay, but I've taken you on a long detour because I like my spin battery and EMF and generalizing Faraday's law and stuff. Let's get back to spin transfer. So if you really believe in my EMF, the first question you ask yourself is, where in the hell does the energy come from? I mean, you have the battery I just showed you. The energy that goes into the electrical circuit comes from chemical processes. So where is the energy coming from here? Well, that's actually easy to answer in physical terms. Namely, it's the magnetic energy that's stored in the wire due to the fact that half of the wire has got the magnetic field in the wrong direction. It's that energy that's being used to drive a current in the external circuit. In order for that to happen, it has to be that the wall is moving, and the wall hasn't moved so far. I just had the wall fixed, and I calculated this Bury phase, and then I took the derivative of the Bury phase with respect to time to give me a force. So something had to move here. I mean, the procedure is okay, but there's something missing. And what about the conservation of angular momentum? I mean, this electron, when it's at this side of the wall, is pointing this way. When it's at this side of the wall, it's pointing that way. Something has to give, has to compensate for the change in angular momentum, that its SZ component over here is plus and minus over there, or the inverse, whichever way you decide to take the Z-axis. And the thing that compensates for that is that the fact that the wall has to move. Okay, so you really have to take into account this term down here. In fact, it has two roles.
Are you answering the second question or the first one? I'm still waiting to hear about the first one. Is that, isn't it where as you change the variable phase, something is about to move? And I thought I understood that. Taking it away from me.
Well, okay, the wall is rotating, but the energy, I mean, the picture of the motion of the EMF is nice from the point of view of the electron. But the point is where really is the energy that that electron's getting through the fact that the wall's exerting a force on it. And it, okay, it's a nice picture to imagine this moving line.
It has to drive the spin space. Something has to change for you.
Okay, so as the thing's going from the top of this sphere in spin space to the bottom, it's going through the wall. And what I'm going to tell you now is that as it goes through the wall actually moves a little bit to conserve the angular momentum. And it's that energy that comes from moving the wall which is actually what's going into the to the electron. In the same way as at the end of the day, if you have a regular motional EMF, it's energy coming from the magnetic field, it's a mechanical energy pulling the bar, which really provides the energy that forces the electrons around the circuit.
And that's what makes delta omega grow. That's all that I want to know.
No, in the same way as...
that's what gives you the emotional EMF. You're taking on the things you really like.
Well, it's cute that it's emotional EMF in spin space, but there's nothing really moving in real space. So it's actually the fact that this coordinate of the electron is not independent of the coordinate of the wall. So there's two things moving at the same time. One is the electron and the other is the wall. So as the electron is this side, the wall is over here, and as the electron moves through the wall moves a little bit. And it's... Well, okay, but if the fields change, that corresponds to a movement of the wall. I mean, the spins that the wall make up stay where they are, but the wall moves because all the little angles move over a little bit and the wall just moves a little bit this way or the other way. Okay, but that's where I'm going to tell you. And the picture's nice and the picture's correct, but I've missed something out, if you will, in throwing away this... term. And that's the thing that ends up conserving both angular momentum and energy. And when you throw this away, as you do in a simple Stoner model or functional density theory, excuse me, there's something missing. The theory doesn't conserve either energy or angular momentum. Okay, but this is a funny situation. It's a domain wall, it's not a regular plane ferromagnet. Okay, so I want to convince you that this is a magic ingredient. Okay, I remind you, there's two of these A's. There's one that came from the Bury phase and this one that came from doing the transformations. I mean, they're both gauge, SU2 gauge fields really, but there's two of them. This is off-diagonal in spin space. So the first role of it, which we're not going to worry about too much, is that it tells you whether the adiabatic approximation is correct. If you go and look in Messiah or something, you're teaching a adiabatic approximation, it actually talks about transverse fields. You get a couple of levels you want to decide whether the adiabatic approximation is valid for. You imagine those as a two-level system and you try and calculate precisely this term, which tells you what the transverse field, which would cause transitions between the two levels, would be. So providing d theta by dz is not too big, which for permalloyed isn't, the adiabatic approximation is good. And those solutions we came up with are okay, with one caveat. Now, what's the caveat? Well, let's ask ourselves what the... so this is beyond Stoner conservation. What's the caveat, which is I've just been trying to say, is that wall moves. So what is the wall coordinate? Well, if you have a uniform piece of ferromagnet with a domain wall in the middle, Sz is equal to zero. And in fact, if you set some distribution of electrons and you move the wall around, what you're changing is the value of Sz. So that to a very good approximation, you can actually take the operator that you calculate, take the expectation value of it at least, and simply take the expectation value of Sz. But this has got a small problem to it because of our one electron that we're trying to follow all day. Namely, when it's over here, it's got one value of SZ, and when it's over here, it's got another value of SZ. So it must be, if SZ stays the same, the contribution to SZ of all of the other electrons must change a little bit by moving the wall. So that's why this is approximation symbols. What we're in the business of is trying to calculate the small correction to this. Now, there must be a small correction, because by putting the wall in, we've cheated a little bit. While Stoner model its more elaborate versions of it are okay, because the spin degree of freedom really is independent for each of the individual electrons that you're going to build a selected determinant out of. It isn't the case now, because the total SZ is constrained by the position of the wall, so that there's one constraint on the individual spin operators of the individual electrons. So you really got a small many-body effect, that the position of the wall and the SZ value of the individual electrons are no longer independent coordinates. So what we want to do is calculate a small correction to the position of the wall due to this AS. And okay, what one does is notice that in that Stoner model where I got rid of all of the vector potentials and I just had these nice plane states like in a uniform ferromagnet, that there's no spin dependence of the position of an electron. Maybe it's a minority electron spin up, it's a spin up over here, it's spin out down over there. So these corrections are this correction is going to be zero if I'm operating on the product space of these states. So I choose, for two reasons, to work in that Hilbert space, because of that fact, plus the fact that in fact this A of S was defined in that Hilbert space. So I take that some arbitrary definition, well, the exact definition of what Z hat is. I'm not going to write down what it is, because I have to put all these corrections to SZ in it, but it's almost SZ, but not quite. It's the real coordinate operator, and actually there should be a hat on it here. I take this into the rotating frame. So if I want to evaluate Z in the rotating frame, I have to evaluate this, okay? This UA is really just this term that was generated by the formal solution, including this vector potential. The vector potential is curl-free, it's irrotational, so you can account for it by just adding this prefactor in standard fashion, which looks like a unitary transformation, so I wrote it that way. And the correction I want is small, as we'll see in a minute, so I simply linearize in A, which generates a commutator involving this vector potential, or more accurately, the integral of it. Okay, R0 is some arbitrary origin well to the right of the wall, and R is the actual position of the electron that I'm interested in. Okay, so let's back up and say what I'm doing. I'm calculating the position change of the wall, which is related to the specific coordinate of one of the electrons that I'm describing. Okay, and this commutator you can do, in fact, since this only involves the spin operator and the spin space of the electron I'm interested in, I only have to pick out the spin operator SZ contribution to this that comes from the same spin space. So this is a trivial thing to evaluate, and this is what the answer is. And okay, this is simply the cosine of the reference position, and the cosine of the position the electron actually is in, and the cosine is just tells you what the projection of SZ is onto the of the actual direction of the electron onto the Z-axis, so that this change in the position of the wall actually just compensates precisely for the fact that the Z component of the electron changes as you go through the wall. Okay, and this is the torque transfer mechanism without any currents flowing. Just looking in the ground state of the system, it tells you that as an electron moves through the wall has to move a little bit. If you start putting a current and start moving electrons through the wall, it always in the same direction. Each time it goes through the wall, one of these delta Z's crops up. This factor here becomes a 2, so the wall just keeps steadily moving over. So it's this small many-body correction to Kohn-Sham theory. To Stoner theory, which you need in order to get spin transfer torque mechanism included in the theory. And if you're not putting that correction in, you're assuming something about spin transfer. This was actually drawn for SD exchange model, but the same picture is the same. Namely, what we're saying is as an electron moves through the wall, the position of all the other spins change a little bit in order that the domain wall moves by this amount delta Z. Okay, so that's just the spin transfer mechanism. And it's nothing more or less than shooting wild commons, loose commons, I guess you say. The total SZ of the system has to stay fixed. So if you move one electron through the system has to recoil, move backwards somehow. So that's all that spin transfer is all about. Okay, and you can get the usual formulas, which were derived in a more formal way in the last talk, by simply saying, well, this is the move, change in the position of the wall per electron. This is the volume, unit cell volume, and this is the amount of spin that's in contained in the unit in that unit cell volume. And that formula I gave you before is equivalent to saying that this is delta Z for one electron going through the wall. If there's a current going through the wall, then you get a certain velocity. Again, because the electron coordinate is related to the position of the wall, there is a velocity if there is a current flowing. In fact, a lot of the time I'd like to look at this the other way, namely, if I force a current to flow through the circuit, the wall has to move. But the thing that that's perhaps new is this, that at the same time, which I didn't explain, if there's this movement of the wall, that means that the Zeeman energy, or the total magnetic energy of the wall, has changed by a little bit. So if you actually let the wall move at some velocity, there are two energies evolved around. There's two energies around. There's the force times the velocity of the wall, which is the amount of change in magnetic energy per unit time. And that's causing a current to flow in an external circuit. So the amount of work per unit time is just the voltage times the current. So if you equate those two things, or if you simply allow for energy conservation, that moving the wall changes the energy of the system, that energy has to be given to the electron either way, or going through this Burry phase stuff, you come up with this expression for the EMF generated by a wall. Okay, so you apply pressure to a wall, it generates an EMF, it will cause a current to flow through the voltmeter, and the wall will move. Okay, so in the last 18 minutes, let's get back to some spintronics and how I would like to describe that, given this theory that one developed from Stoner theory, adding some relaxation in. So, Noether spoils the fun of electronics because there's a conserved current which gives you Kirchhoff's node rule, and then there's a definition of EMF which gives you Kirchhoff's loop rule. Well, when you teach elementary physics, you use these two rules, these two laws disguised to analyze circuits like that. The force that goes into the EMF is just the regular Lorentz force. And when you get to spintronics, you should be doing something fancier, because you should include the Stern-Gerlach force, which is the one that just produced this EMF that I've been trying to convince you is real. Even at the level of the continuity equation lies more complicated, simply because the thing that we're looking at is the magnetization, which is a vector, so that the current is a tensor. So the continuity equation, there's nothing else more complicated. But it is more complicated because the magnetic field causes there to be a time derivative of the magnetic field, even if there's no divergence of the spin current. And then the thorny issue, which I'll just put as an R, is the relaxation, that spin currents aren't conserved, unlike charge currents, so you have to worry about relaxation as well. Okay, and you have to worry about where B comes from, that's the internal field, and in this Landau-Lipschitz theory, the B is got by taking the derivative of some total energy function. Okay, one divergence we would have with several other people in this business is that this term is where the torque transfer action comes from. If you have a current going through some system here, it's looking like a bit like a domain wall, where the magnetization from slice to slice changes direction, even though the current is constant, and even though the magnitude of the spin current is a constant, its direction changes, so there's a divergence. And you can actually show that all the spin transfer stuff can be accounted for by just accounting for that divergence term in the equation. And it's absolutely nothing to do with the energy functional that gives you a magnetic field. Okay, that gets us to Mr. Gilbert. I found this photograph somewhere. Okay, Gilbert relaxation has been a catch term in ferromagnetic resonance for 40 years. Actually, it's a bit false pretenses, because the original Landauer-Lipschitz equations actually have this relaxation term in them, which most people realize if alpha is small, and this is the equation of motion for the magnetization, the two are equivalent to first order. But they're actually completely equivalent mathematically. You can show that this is equivalent to this. There's some renormalization of the G factor, which I think is false, but mathematically there's absolutely no difference between Gilbert and Landau Lipschitz relaxation if there's no divergence term in the equation. And most experiments of spintronics came around were done on systems with no divergence term in them. So there's really no difference between Gilbert and Landau Lipschitz. Okay, this is my favorite little game, which is to try and look at relaxation in a system which is closed. So I want to get rid of a battery and put in a couple of reservoirs, and then put a wire between the two reservoirs, and the reservoirs kind of replace the battery. And actually, following the last talk, we want to write down a Lagrangian for it. Okay, there's actually the dot in a different place, which you can figure as integration by parts on the kinetic energy term. In fact, both of these terms are kind of Berry phase terms. This is the kinetic energy from the Berry phase, and this is the spin torque coupling. So it's a term which is proportional to the current, the charge derivative on the on our plates is the current that's flowing through the circuit. And so what I've added is the wall, but I've got a new coordinate, which is the charge on my capacitor plates, so that there's an energy at the capacitor plates, which is something positive for capacitor. And this is the K perpendicular term. It's the thing that gives a domain wall energy. As you tilt it out of the plane, it's actually a cosine in reality, but since I don't want to tilt it too far out of the plane, which is the case if the currents aren't too big in this theory of dynamics of domain walls, I can keep this as just a quadratic term, which is kind of neater to play with. Okay, so again, this is the kinetic energy. This gives you essentially the dm by dt term in the Landau-Lipschitz equations. This is the torque transfer term. It actually gives you the divergence term in the Landau-Lipschitz equations. But you notice both of them are kinetic energy terms. They've got a dot on them. So the Hamiltonian doesn't involve torque transfer, and it's just the sum of the anisotropy energy, which is this term, plus the energy of the capacitor, which is this term, both of which are positive. So already there's some problem, because this solution that would have intrinsic pinning has a finite angle phi. So it's got a positive energy compared to a ground state, which would have phi equal to zero and q equal to zero. Okay, and as Tartar and Kono pointed out, Gilbert relaxation is actually equivalent to this Rayleigh dissipation function. Remember all this stuff with Lagrangians you had to teach sometime, or at least the older guys like I do have to. You write out the Landau-Lipschitz equations, and if you want to put relaxation in, you put a derivative with respect to the velocity with a minus sign of a function on the other side of the equation. And that's the thing you differentiate, is this Rayleigh dissipation function. And this is pinched from one of from Kono's articles, except I've rendered everything dimensionless. I don't like all these lambdas and all that stuff around, so I've set the wall width equal to 1 and lots of other nasty things equal to 1 to make this simple mathematically. Okay, on those equations, if I set up the Landau Litchfield equations, I get these. Okay, these are the standard equations which Professor Tartar showed you a few minutes ago, well, probably an hour ago, which are the equations of motion. I've taken his convention to take the wall position to be x. I should have said that already. Alpha, again, is this dissipation constant. And these are just the standard equations of motion when there's only torque transfer. There's no force in these equations. You get one more equation because I've got the charge as a coordinate in this system. So I get actually a definition of my EMF that I've been trying to convince you I existed, namely that the external voltage, which is the derivative of the capacitor plate's energy with respect to Q, which is the voltage of a capacitor, must be equal to phi point, which in these dimensionless units simply says that the domain wall is producing an EMF which exactly balances the external battery, which is being replaced by this capacitor. There's no resistances in my circuit, so there's no difference between the internal and external EMFs. The EMF generated by the wall has to be equal to that. This is more a thought experiment. So I want to examine the role of relaxation. So I'm putting in this Gilbert relaxation term into the equations of motion using this regular formalism. This is a toy model for our domain wall, which gives the correct equations of motion. And with this really dissipation function gives us the correct dissipation in quotation marks. Okay, so those are the correct equations, but actually I got two equations really for phi point, which is kind of obvious if I turn off relaxation. The phi point equation says it's equal to zero, which actually determines what the voltage of the capacitor is, which has to be zero. And in fact, if you wanted to, okay, that the U by dQ is equal to zero means you're at a minimum of my capacitor. So I can make it go as Q squared over C, but if I actually want a current to flow for any length of time, I actually need C to go to infinity. But I can actually turn on my relaxation and consider a situation where that C is finite. So, okay, the fact that when I'm at the position phi equal to zero let's back up. What I want to do now is take my wall, which is actually just sliding along because there's no relaxation, I should have said that. X point is equal to the current, so Q point is the current, the velocity is equal to the current, so my domain wall is simply sliding along with a zero voltage across the system. Okay, now I'm going to set up my U to be Q squared over 2C and turn on the relaxation. Now, I'm at the bottom of the well, because at the bottom of the U, because my dU by dQ is equal to zero. I'm at a minimum because the initial voltage was zero. But now I turn on adiabatically by putting the system in contact with a relaxation system. I start making the system go to higher U. Now, the U by dt is just the U by dq times Q prime, just using the chain rule, so that's the EMF times the charge. So since I started off at a minimum, that has to be greater than zero, so Q point has to be greater than zero. So that tells me that the EMF has to be greater than zero. So I start off turning on the relaxation, phi was equal to zero, the wall was in its original plane. The velocity was given by the current, which doesn't change suddenly. Now phi point is equal to the EMF, and we just convinced ourselves that's positive. But now I have a spare equation left over for phi point, so instead I write it as an equation for alpha. The equation for alpha is minus phi point over x point. The wall is moving in the positive direction. We convinced ourselves that E was positive, which means phi points is positive, which tells you that alpha is actually negative. It's true that for such a Hamiltonian system, if you look in some page in Goldstein, that dH by dt is actually minus 2 times F, which should mean that dH by dt is negative. but the alpha parameter has the wrong sign, so the h by dt is positive, so that if you put in this relaxation term, the Gilbert term, the system goes from lower energy to higher energy by putting in contact with the heat bath, and that isn't allowed by the second law. So you have to go back and say what went wrong. And what went wrong is actually having the five-point equation. Okay, what's wrong is Gilbert relaxation says that relaxation can apply a pressure to a wall. Now this is actually a little bit strange, because the pressure on the wall is equivalent to a magnetic field. So if you put a magnetic field onto a wire, this end has high energy, this end has low energy, and there's a pressure, because as I move the wall along, the energy of the system changes. Now if I put on relaxation, I change the pressure. Relaxation is something that's occurring where the wall is. How does that change the energy of those two ends of the wire that are a long way away from the wall? So it's not sensible to have relaxation changing phi point. The other way of looking at it is phi point is just the Zeeman energy. It's the splitting between the energy levels of the system. And normally when you turn on relaxation, it produces an imaginary part of a self-energy which broadens the levels, but it isn't supposed to shift the levels. So, and several reasons, it's illogical to have relaxation both in this, which is x and phi are actually conjugate coordinates. It's illogical to have relaxation in both of the momentum equation and the velocity equation. It should be in one or the other, and the place it should be is here and not up there.
Well, you could have you can say it a different language, you have a complex F, where the real part, you know, there's a reactive part, there's a dissipative part, and then the reactive part goes to the pressure, and the dissipative part, which goes to the primary stone, all of this stuff. I mean, so he's using, you're right, and he's using one thing for two rows. So, nonetheless, you know, if you think of that dissipation comes from some other mechanical system, you can square it out.
Yeah, but this is the Hamiltonian of the system, including...
No, but you have, for F, you think of another big reservoir, and you have to do the mechanical for that. And then the force can either give you dissipation as well as some reactive element.
I mean, you can put something else in the Lagrangian which represents some force, some new phenomena coming from your relaxation mechanism, if you will. And I'm not saying that's not impossible, that you could put in a term which is x times b, which is the equivalent of a magnetic field. Okay, that produces a pressure. And maybe there are some mechanisms which do that,
So all I want to do is to say, you know, the force is the cause of the dissipation, and we can do the extra part of the dissipation, and then that is the pressure. I don't understand why we would want to use the force of the pressure in the dissipation.
Okay, but I mean, I'm supposed to invent a function down here which causes a base, the second law of thermodynamics. And what I'm trying to tell you is that if I create a pressure on the wall from relaxation, if this term exists, I can actually put an alpha 1 and alpha 2 here, and it's the alpha 1 that causes the problem that this is gives you an increasing energy. Okay, you're agreeing with me now.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
I agree with you. I'm saying that you can fix that.
Well, I can fix it by producing a mechanism that really produces a pressure on the wall. For example, the fact that the electrons get reflected with a certain probability.
You can have an external system. system that also put the pressure on the wall, which is specified that you use the two parts of the connector part. If that generates by dynamics, you should obey the final stomach equation.
Actually, we don't need anything. I mean, we can forget about the special function and calculate the torque for instance from the electron in the presence of spin field. And then we can find that, we find that can you show the equation motion? We can show that without any special function, we can show that the pressure alpha x appears from the spin field, and also the same thing appears in the spin. Alpha hydro. So it's just purely a kind of torque arising from the electron in the presence of spin. And that's what also it can give power and all the hydrogen. So we don't have to say it's a displacement. We can just carefully derive the torque and find that some alpha here, there, and here.
So are you getting dissipation?
Yeah. But if I come back to this, which okay, if I have a wire, okay, I have the domain wall somewhere in the middle, and ask myself, what is the pressure? Okay, 5 point is given by the pressure on the wall. Now, the pressure on the wall is given by the derivative of the energy with respect to the coordinate. Now, I don't care whatever happens in the vicinity of the wall here, if I move this wall around, by some amount z, there's a derivative in the energy because I'm essentially taking some wrongly directed spins and putting them in the correct direction, so the energy goes from one to the other. So unless I have some mechanism that somehow can change the energy of the systems that far away from the wall, I can't get a pressure. Now, okay, there are things that can do that. I mean, if the wall has a resistance, as I send a current through it, I have to have a potential energy difference. I have to have a chemical potential which is different to the right and different to the left in order to drive the current through the wall. So if the wall has a resistance, i.e. the electrons are exerting a pressure on it, then I shift the chemical potential to either side and that does give me a pressure term. But unless I do something like that, okay, I mean, a wall resistance will exert a pressure on the main wall. I have no objection to that. But that somehow isn't a dissipation term. I don't see how I can get anything into this 5-point equation which doesn't involve changing the chemical potentials one way or another far from the wall. Okay, a wall resistance will do it. Applied magnetic field will do it. This change in geometry, pinning potentials, and the like, all do it. But you need that the energy is somehow a function of SZ, that I don't see how a simple.
What I'm suggesting is that if you use the X dot to drive five dot.
Sure. I mean, then all you're saying is that there's a self-energy which has a real and imaginary part, which are related by. Okay, but I prefer thinking quantum mechanically. I mean, there's some self-energy for the, which has a real and imaginary part. Okay, and it's the real part which would appear in the pressure equation, because essentially the rate, I mean, if you're thinking, if you want to produce a classical state that's rotating, what you need to do is to build a coherent state, which is a linear combination of SZ states and okay, whatever the time dependence of the prefactor is, determines how fast the thing is rotating. So basically the eigenstates, because I left rotational symmetry in my model, are eigenstates of SZ, and you take some linear combination of them in order to get the rotational motion. And the rotational motion corresponds to a pressure. So the fact that you have a system of levels which have some separation between them, delta ESZ, directly means that there's a PZ. So in order to get something which enters in this equation, what you have to do is to produce something which changes the energy level separation between eigenstates of different values of SZ. And okay, there are a number of ways of doing that, but a simple relaxation like some spin flip or spin orbit relaxation of the convection electrons, which is only going to be effective in the region of the wall, certainly can't do that. I mean, anything that just occurs in this regional wall for a uniform wire in a magnetic field is not going to alter the splitting of this Zeeman splitting, which is just tells you how much the energy changes when I move the wall, and that's something to do with the energies far from where the wall is, because the energy of the wall isn't changing as I change its position. So I would claim that there are things like the domain wall resistance, but in general, it's very hard to imagine some relaxation process like spin orbit scattering of the convection electrons in the region of the wall, which is actually going to produce a pressure on the wall. And therefore, I think that there something which is capable of causing the 5-point to go to zero is unphysical. You essentially have to collapse the entire Zeeman splitting of the wire. You've killed off the Zeeman energy for the wire far from where the wall is, and that just isn't physical.
So you show us this Lagrangian for this slide, and is it the same Lagrangian as in the first talk, or is there already some difference on this level?
I think it's the same. I mean, I prefer having the dot on here, which I was surprised you had on it. I put the dot on the phi, not on the x. But I mean, in a Lagrangian, that doesn't make any difference. It differs by an absolute derivative. This is the torque transfer term. Actually, I don't like this because this has the wrong symmetry. It should be independent of phi, but it does give the correct equations of motion. So as a toy model, I live with it. So. And this is essentially the same Lagrangian as was written out before, except I've taken the cosine and just taken the dropped the constant and taken the expansion in it.
But I think the situation is different from the experiment where they apply a voltage on the battery does get flat, right? But here it's something that the condenser is just oscillating and there's no of it.
Well, actually, the thing that does work here is relaxation. But I mean, it's true. I've left off dissipation in the wire, but I mean, in a thought experiment, I'm allowed to do that. I mean, they're ferromagnetic superconductors, if you will. Having a current with no dissipation, I don't see as something that I can't do in a Gedanken experiment. I mean,
in the previous one, there was this cosine term, there's this Albert plane.
That's this linearized. It's a thing which is k perpendicular cosine squared, I guess, of phi. Actually, it had a sine squared of theta in it beforehand, but I don't care too much about what the coefficient in front is. So you average this thing through the wall, which gives you something that goes out in front, and then there's a cosine dependence, which means that the lowest energy is when the system has theta equals zero, so there must be a minus sign in there.
So you claim that your Lagrangian is the same as like the previous talk. So why there's some discrepancy there in your red
dot? No, there's not.
But I don't agree with. I mean, the modeling of the battery is quite different from the reality, I guess. So I don't agree with still the Islam runtime the same as the experiment or our aluminum. We don't care about the battery. It's impossible to model the battery. It's a non-equilibrium. So we forget about that. And anyway, there's extra work done by battery. So there's a, no, the state is totally different from this.
I don't understand that. I mean, I can, if I want water to flow down a tube, I just put a reservoir, I put more water in a reservoir on this side than on the other side, and that causes water to flow. I mean, I have a charge reservoir, I put more charge in this side, that causes a current to flow through. What's the difference between that and putting a battery? So that I can close the system. If I want to have a, I can, if you want, we can go through the exercise of taking maybe a couple of domain walls and putting a dB by dt through it, if that would make you happier, so that there's an induced EMF. Okay, so it's what everyone would agree is an EMF. And that problem you can do as well if you want, and follow where the energy is going around.
Can you remind us from this equation, how do you get phi dot equal to plus alpha x dot equal to zero?
You mean without relaxation, this one?
No, how do you get that first equation?
The first equation. Okay, you look at the x equation, so let's go back to the Lagrangian so you can see what I'm doing. Okay, so I start taking the derivative with respect to x, so I have the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x is minus phi, and I have d by dt of the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x point, which is equal to zero, minus the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to x is equal to, I guess it's minus the derivative of the f function as a function of x point. Okay, this is equal to zero. Okay, this gives me plus phi point. Okay, that's the only x in the whole equation is that one. And if I take the derivative of this equation, I should have put a half in here. I'm sorry. I would get alpha minus alpha times minus alpha times x point. Sorry, again, there should be a half in there. And okay, I have to look in Goldstein to remember whether it really should be a minus sign in there or not, but I assure you I did check it. So that gives me that equation. Okay, if you want to look at the x equation, you take the equation in which you worry about differentiating with respect to phi. There is a phi point in here, so I get a minus x point. And the equation sort of gets switched around. If you want differentiating with respect to phi, you get an x equation. Okay, the phi from here gives me something like plus q point, coupling to the current. And then this term gives me the term that's the velocity due to the perpendicular anisotropy. And then the other phi-point equation comes from differentiating with respect to q. So there's a q-point term there, which gives me a phi-point. And then the other differentiation with respect to q is the du by dq. So this just gives me phi-point is du by dq. And it's the fact that there's two equations for phi point, which means that the system determines the sign of alpha rather than you being allowed to choose it to be positive.
So I'm suggesting that when you add the dissipation function, you have to add something to the Lagrangian.
Okay, then, all bets are off. I mean, it's true, you can invent some.
Think of another system, a continuum system where you have to
model the reservoir.
I mean, I agree with you, but I'm trying to fix it. I'm saying the way to fix it is to actually add some.
Well, I still...
You're not allowed to arbitrarily add functions.
Okay, that I agree with, and that's the point I'm trying to make, is that this f function shouldn't have this term in it. It should only have that, which is fairly normal in equations of motion. I mean, essentially phi and x are conjugate coordinates, and you normally don't put a relaxation term in both the definition of what the momentum is, and in the this equation, you take the current out and the relaxation says that phi is x point is actually the definition of the momentum for x, and this is the dp by dt equals a force equation at the top, and normally you don't put relaxation in both the definition of momentum and you put it in the force equation, but then conjugate momenta can always be switched around, so I believe that really this is the coordinate and x is the momentum. What I didn't get to say was maybe just two rapid points. I mean, this is the same data you saw before. I think it's pretty linear here. Okay, why does this thing crop up in experiment, which is this critical current that you heard about in the last talk, and which seems to fit into experiment some way? And okay, if there's intrinsic pinning, what you find is that if the current's less than the pinning potential, okay, this thing sort of rattles around inside the pinning potential. On the other hand, if you're above the critical current but below this characteristic one, what happens is it rattles around for a while, and only after a while does it come over the top. And only if you satisfy this condition will it go over the top. This is for strongish pinning, very weak pinning. This isn't true. So if you have pretty strong pinning, which is perhaps the case in some experiments, this ends up being some characteristic field which can occur in experiment, and maybe it's the case in Bigono's experiments. Okay, these are my devices. This is, I guess, was invented by Mike Coy, the peanut memory device. What we want to do is to say, well, if I want to read this, or this is in the zero state, I send a current pulse into here. This will lift this wall through the torque transfer to this point here. But now, because of the geometry, there's a force on the wall, and that means that there's a pulse comes out of this circuit. Now you can write down equations, and what's neat about this electronics is you can get a gain by having something that looks like this. But you've latched the thing at the beginning of the cycle up here, so that it gives you energy when it falls down to the low energy point. So you can build a whole electronic circuit with no semiconductors, and in principle, if you can get the internal resistances to zero, you have no dissipation. Because all you're doing is moving magnetic energy from one place to another. I mean, you can never get rid of dissipation, but you can set up you have power gain from this thing. You can easily set up gates, NORs, and all those sort of things. So you can imagine doing whole magnetic logic without any semiconductors, all hard against atomic bombs and such things. Well, I mean, that's how Stu Wolf got into it. He tried to sell. They had a unit that was this big, and he ended up getting something this small. Okay, so conclusions are. Okay, one thing we differ with a lot of people who want to get the torque transfer coming from the S dot S interaction is that we insist it comes from the divergence in the Landau-Lichfield equation, which doesn't fit into any energy function. Okay, energy conservation implies that there's this EMF, which I like to call Berry-Fay's version of Faraday's law. Okay, I didn't say this. You can fix up Gilbert's term by putting in what we call a particle derivative, or I think it's called a covariant derivative in some places. Okay, and the big difference we have is that we think that spinning is extrinsic and caused by alpha, caused by relaxation. Sorry, I went off for an hour 20.